Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is Fabio Tembosi. Fabio is the Senior Vice President of Global Marketing for ESL Faceit Group, one of the dominant players in the booming business of esports. Just had a huge event, well over 50,000 in Dallas. We've got the Esports World Cup coming up, all kinds of stuff to talk about. So we are thrilled to talk to you from the great city of Amsterdam, where you recently moved. One of my favorite places to be, a great creative hub for our industry and the world more broadly. So Fabio, a hearty welcome. Thrilled to talk to you.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, excited.
All right. So let's start with Juve Consulting. We happen to know Ziad and his team just acquired by UTA, dear friends of ours at the United Talent Agency. And some of Ziad's people actually participated with us at our Climatech event in Boston. We were thrilled to have them on stage. I think in my mind, and I'm a little older, but I think there's a real tie between that demographic and esports. And we're going to talk about your whole career. You've had an incredible career. I don't know too many people who have worked at three of the iconic sports and footwear brands, and really broader than that, lifestyle brands. We'll talk about Nike and Adidas and Saucony. But let's start talking about your role as an advisory board member, successful based on the outcome, with Ziad and the team at Juve Consulting.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I met Ziad, I think when he was like 17, 18 years old. And somebody told me like, hey, you have to meet this guy. He has this Gen Z, he's 25 now, right? He's like, he's just Gen Z consulting company out of New York. And I was in New York at that time for a business trip. And I came into their office at a WeWork space, supposedly to be there for 30 minutes. And then I think I was there for 3 hours. I was just fascinated by his energy, by his intelligence, and by his drive, and by the people. It wasn't just him, right? It was like his, I think most of the people there are still there with him. And then you fast forward, I think 2 years, 3 years, he reached out to me and he's like, look, we need to grow, we need to accelerate. And to be quite honest, like we find ourselves in these rooms with corporate leaders that think we're having a hard time to close some deals, or we're having a hard time to understand how to drive the business. So he built an advisory board of 13 people. And for 4 years, we would meet on a quarterly basis and guide and advise them on how to set up the business and grow the business. And fast forward, phenomenal job. I was actually just with Ziad last week at Pital Summit. And it was a little bit, it was really cool to see him and celebrating toast to his success. But I take absolutely no credit. I was just there asking silly questions and poking holes. And it's all credit to him and his team. He has a phenomenal team with him.
So good stuff. And I really think UTA did very well to acquire a group that connects with the demographic that advertisers and brands most value. And I always find this conversation interesting. I think I'm a little older than you. I'm 59. And, you know, I'm not wealthy, but I have a little bit of money. And because of my age, advertisers and brands do not care about me at all. They care deeply about my daughter, by way of example, who's age 26. That's the demo that Juve targets, esports and e-gaming, very big part of that ecosystem. What's your take on the value given to that demo? Is it overvalued? And thoughts on the other side of other demographics, older in particular, being largely dismissed by advertisers and brands?
It's interesting. First, I don't think it's overvalued, right? Gen Zs right now represent 27% of the workforce. They're 37% of the world population. I think they have the largest spending power of any generation that preceded them, right? So if you're closing your eyes to them, or you're kind of like, hey, I'll take care of later, I think we as marketing leaders were missing quite a lot, because they're not about the future, they're the present. So I think, you know, hard reality is one of the things that I love about Gen Z is like a lot of people try to understand them. But for me, the sooner you actually accept them, the better off you are, because they come in with very different demands of the workforce, very different demands and expectations. They're a purpose-driven consumer that if your brand doesn't stand on the pillars of core values, they'll call you out. And they have this incredible power that other generations didn't have, which is they're native to digital, they're native to social media, which they can either amplify your brand or they can cancel your brand very quickly.
Absolutely true. We'll come back to Gen Z as we dig more into what's happening now at EFG. But let's go back a little bit and talk about your career. You originally from Brazil, worked in some great companies. I've been to São Paulo a number of times. It's a wonderful place. I also have a good story for you. I was in, oh gosh, what was Pele's club? Santos?
Santos,
So
yeah.
I knew Professor Julio Mazzei, who was his coach
Oh,
at the
wow.
Cosmos. And when the World Cup was in America in 94, I was a young kid and I was running the sports commission for New York and was in charge of the New York City
Oh,
bid and
wow.
piece of the World Cup in 94. As you know, it's about to be back here again in 2026. And I was there speaking on something. I spoke on a panel with Pele at a conference in São Paulo. And then they took us to Santos. And it was a very old stadium. It's where he scored most of his goals on a percentage basis over the length of his career. And I literally went into the bathroom for a second, and my interpreter said, Matt, somebody's here. Somebody knows you. And I'm like, there's no way that someone knows me in Santos Stadium in Brazil. And it was Professor Mazzei. He was there, and we had a big reunion. I'm sure he's long gone now, but there was that moment in the 70s when the Cosmos was a big deal, and when Pele and Beckenbauer, Canalha. Okay, so that's my little Brazil story. But let's go back. You work for some great companies, starting with IBM way back when, going back about 20 some odd years. Talk about that as a foundation for you and those early remembrances working for IBM in São Paulo.
It is interesting because my life has been changed entirely by two things: sports and education. Right? I started my life in Brazil with just the goal of becoming a professional soccer player. And then little did I know that that was my dream and probably another 200 million people's dream. So it's not that easy. And I remember when I graduated from Clemson University, I played soccer at Clemson University. I went back home and I didn't make to the MLS Super Draft. And most of my teammates actually got picked on the draft. And I went back home and my dad was like, well, finally you're gonna get a good job, because he didn't think like playing soccer was a career. And then I did what my dad wanted me to do, which is getting a good job. So I got a good job at IBM. And I was a pricer. So I was working with supporting the sales organization in the United States and pricing IBM services. It's when IBM was shifting from hardware to software to consulting. And I tell you, Matt, it was probably one of the hardest 2 years of my life, because I mean, I'm not good with numbers. I was doing pricing, but I tell you, it strengthened the foundation of business understanding that I only, back then I took for granted, but 10, 15 years later in my career, I was able to really understand a proper P&L, margins, and really have a much deeper business acumen. Because one of the things that IBM is great is actually training you when you're young and coming up. And so I got a lot of training on business management, business acumen, commercial development. And as a marketer, you fast forward 20 plus years, as you said, it's even more and more important that you can justify your ROI in marketing. It's no longer about what I call the spray and pray marketing strategy that you just throw something out on TV and hope that you get traction.
Absolutely. So that foundation notion ends up being right. Your passion for sports, however, cannot be tamped down. And you've obviously got a little entrepreneurial spirit in you as well. And you launch your own firm after a few years.
Yeah, I started with just I was at IBM and going like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And then my soccer coach at Clemson University, he had a camp. I mean, you're from the US, like summer camps. And For 4 years, I worked in his soccer camp as a college student. In the last 2 years, I worked a lot more on the administration side of things. And then I knew that he had 800 kids on a standby list that he could simply not serve. So I came to him with a business plan and say, well, what if we offer them a soccer camp in Brazil? I'm like, we're not going to compete with the kids that you already have in the camp. At that time, he had about 2,000 kids in the summer. So I put a business plan and we launched the Brazil Soccer Academy. And we ran that for about 4 years. But it also, I was very lucky to have clients like Pepsi in Brazil, and Nokia was one of my clients. So I've learned how to chase and develop the business, grow the agency. But what I did not have, it was the management knowledge of actually, I was 23 at that time, 22. I was just like, oh my gosh, I made a lot of money. It was 200 grand. But then like things would have cost me 190,000 to make, right? So it was really good. It was another one that taught me how to be resourceful in the corporate world.
Fantastic stuff. Somewhere you then get recruited to work for one of the great companies, at that time, a really great company, and that's working for Nokia.
Correct. Yeah. Nokia was one of my clients when I had my own business. And at the end of our relationship as an agency to client, the marketing director in Middle East and Africa reached out to me and said, hey, we're probably not going to run the program we used to run with you guys anymore. But hey, I have a role coming up to be marketing manager for Middle East and Africa based out of Dubai for smartphones. Would you be interested? I'm like, yeah, I know nothing about technology. I know nothing about smartphones. Like, but you're curious. You have the mindset and the discipline of an athlete. You're still young. I think you're gonna be great. So that's then I joined Nokia in Dubai as a marketing manager for Middle East and Africa smartphones or business unit.
This marks the beginning of a real global journey for you in a sense. And you mentioned earlier that you have a 9-year-old daughter who's lived in 9 countries. You've got the benefit of true global perspective. Talk about what you saw in Dubai in the UAE back then, give or take 15 years ago, and look at where it is in the world now. Look at where Saudi and Riyadh is. We just had a project in Riyadh, about 20,000 attendees for an event that our team collaborated on with two of the ministries over there, the Communications Information Technology Ministry and the Media Ministry, all about building the advertising and media growth sector. But give us your perspective on what you saw then, and did you see the growth coming back then out of that part of the world?
I'll be very honest with you. Like, no, I didn't, right? Like, I didn't. The Saudi Arabia and the Dubai and the North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa that I experienced, it's completely different than what it is today. But what I did see, which was a very positive surprise, is even back then in 2005, 2008, it was a country with people with the much more open-minded than I ever would imagine to be. I made great friends. It's a great sense of community in the Middle East. It's a very welcoming society. And it's really, we need to do a much better job in demystifying what that is. This truly global experience that you described, what has taught me is, and apply this as a marketing, is think about this. When I was at Nokia, right? I had to market the Nokia N95, which back then it was the most advanced smartphone in the world, right? We had GPS, we had, 10 megapixel camera. And I had to market that product in Sub-Saharan Africa, which is, a country that you cannot sell a 200, 300 euro smartphones without having subsidy of operators and your partners. But then you have to take the same product and go to Saudi Arabia, where price is actually not an issue. Price, it's actually on the contrary, right? If you subsidize the product, people don't see the product as a high quality. So I've learned quite a lot during my time in the Middle East and Africa about positioning, about storytelling, and about creating demand and desire for a product that is exactly the same product, but you have to position it in a very different way, and depending on the market that you're going in.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, evolving growth story. And you can argue that the center of global economic power has shifted dramatically. You know, going back to those days when you were looking at Excel spreadsheets at IBM and trying to figure out all the math to today. And I think we'll continue to see that. I know I'm a proud American. I have a lot of friends in the UK and Europe. But you can argue, I think very credibly, that while we are still an enormous economic engine, that our best days may be behind us and the best days of other places are ahead of them. Places like, you know, MENA and I think Southeast Asia, and there's a couple other places I think that really represent the future. China, because of geopolitics, is a wild card, but obviously a force to be reckoned with, as is India.
100%. I think, not to get political about the conversation, but you've seen a huge shift on the geopolitical aspect of power shift, but also economic growth coming from the East a lot more than the West, right? The West is a much more mature marketplace, and the growth potential, to your point, India, Middle East and Africa, the spending power that comes from those regions, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, no, really, that's a big watch this space going forward. So we have so much to talk about, and I want to make sure that we really focus in on what you're doing now in the esports arena. But you had three great runs at three great companies, a long run at Nike, a lot of different gigs, goes back to your passion for football. Adidas, another great brand, and more recently, Saucony. Talk about, you know, that general part of your career, a pretty big part of your career. Let's start with Nike, which is just, you know, one of the great brands, you know, that this world has ever seen, going back to the creator Phil Knight.
Yeah, Nike is the single best MBA and brand marketing storytelling. There is hands down, like I know I'm biased, right? But I feel like I'm privileged, and I had the luck and the fortune to see across multiple industries, technology, sport culture. But Nike's obsession with storytelling and really tap into the dreams of people is the number one thing you can learn. I remember when I joined Nike, coming in from Nokia, which at that time were the number one most loved brand in the world, thinking I was a hot shit, pardon my French here, and going in there and being very humbled by what I've learned in my time there. Nike is incredible in innovation, incredible in storytelling. It's a fearless culture. And I remember doing my entire interview process, I think I did 13 interviews, and not once they asked me about any previous project that I did. And I remember being a little bit frustrated with, like, well, why they don't want to know about this phone that I launched? Why they don't want to know about this project I did? But they hire people for cultural fit. It's about the mindset of, wanting to be great.
And talk about that wanting to be great, that spirit of invention, of reinvention, you know, the incredible campus and what they built out in Oregon, completely unique, really quite an incredible story and very much an evolving story.
I think Nike believes that the best work is yet to come. Like, Nike never settles. I've had an experience where you thought you had a campaign ready to go to market, but we just felt it wasn't ready. So we would delay just to make sure you put your best work forward. One of my favorite experiences of my Nike time is that when we start a brainstorming session of a creative brief, we will never start thinking about how we're going to win market share. We would start the creative development with how do we want to be remembered in 10, 15, 20 years from now? Like, what is it that we're going to deliver and produce that's going to inspire generations to come? And it will become a timeless piece, right? And I think it's when once you approach the creative process through that lens, it's a completely different approach if you go, hey, I need to win 3% of market share in footwear, right? It's about creating demand, and it's a pull marketing school versus a push marketing school.
So interesting. You also had a great run, also a global role at Adidas, another great brand.
Yeah. Again, very lucky, very fortunate. Again, like another brand, it's obsessed with delivering great product, right? I think, Nike, it's an innovation company. Adidas, it's a product excellence company. So what I was able to learn at Adidas, it was about product excellence. It's about operational excellence. It's the German way of operating and thinking, and that's very ingrained. But at the same time, it's a brand that was founded by Adidas, which was also a big innovator, disruptor, and a challenger. They both excel in different ways. They're both unique and distinctive in their own ways. And when I was there, I was lucky to work under the, not reporting directly to him, but I work under the leadership of Eric Liedtke, who to me, he used to do this 90-day town halls where he would just come in and give us brand updates and all that. I tell you, I might be, exposing myself, but there's so many of them that I actually would leave with tears in my eyes of how inspiring Eric was. And I think, that's one of the things also I've had the fortune to be touched by some of the greatest in their field. Eric was there for almost 20, no, he was there for 26 years.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, no, another great brand story, and I'm very good friends with a guy who just wrote a book, Rob Krasmark. He was at ISL, which all comes out of Horst Dassler and the early days of the Olympic Global Top Program. Rob's book is terrific. It's The Olympics Don't Take American Express, and it really tells the story of the evolution of sports marketing. And Horst Dassler, and we say Adidas, and in Germany, I know they say Adidas, have a really played an oversized role in shaping the global sports marketing community, which a lot of people don't really know.
Oh, 100%. From the Olympics all the way to the World Cup.
Yep, absolutely. And let's jump ahead. Global CMO at Saucony, a brand that has gone up and down, but has really had quite a resurgence.
It's good turnaround the last 2, 3 years. Joined Saucony again through those relationships you have. One of my great friends from Nike, his name is Sean Hoyt. He was the chief product officer at Saucony, and he reached out to me and said, "Hey, we're looking for CMO." And I was like, "Well, what is Saucony?" I did not know. And then doing my homework, I learned that Saucony, back when I joined, it was 123 years old company. And for me, it was my first step into a CMO role or in a public traded company where you all of the things you got promoted for are the things that they don't teach you until you get there, and you kind of learn by fire. Right. And I came in at Saucony with the brief to transform the brand and reposition the brand and reclaim our heritage. And a few things that also Boston company, I know you said you're in Boston not too long ago. A few things that I discovered at Saucony is, in 1965, NASA commissioned Saucony to design the very first space boot that was worn by astronaut Edward, and he was the first astronaut that walked in space, not on the moon. And when I found that, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing!" And I remember internally, people like, "What does it have to do with running?" I mean, nothing, but it has to do with we are an innovation company, and nobody can challenge us on that because, I mean, NASA commissioned us to develop a product that went to space. And then we actually found the picture, we found the boot. So that became the propelling platform to reposition where we moved our innovation efforts to be, we exist to make humans faster. And then along those lines, right, when you go down to the Saucony history, also 123 years old, the company was founded before Adi Dassler or Phil Knight and Bill Bowerman were born. So in our repositioning, we've made a claim and we repositioned the brand as we are the original running brand. So you couldn't dispute that because, it's like 123 years old. Adidas at that time was 70. Nike was not even 50 years old. And that was a huge way to reposition the brand, to lead with innovation and really start putting the brand into the hearts and minds of people. And then you fast forward, I think the last 2, 3 years, Saucony has experienced an incredible growth. And at that time, I think we went from like 300 mil to 600 million in revenue in a year and a half. So it was an incredible experience for me as well. I don't take any of those moments I had in my life for granted.
What a great run. I wonder how Saucony and New Balance also in Boston. Interesting.
Well, you have Converse there as well, and then you have Puma as well.
And
Puma
Reebok. Was Reebok also Massachusetts?
Reebok, yeah.
Yeah. Way back when. Interesting. Okay.
I think the two centers of like footwear and sport cities, you're talking about Boston and Portland.
Yeah.
If you go to Portland now, you have Adidas, you have On, you have Under Armour, you have Nike, because they want to tap into talent that's actually in those locations. So it's either Boston or Portland.
Yeah, great story. Yeah, I didn't. Portland, you think of Nike, of course, but much more than that. So let's start to get to the present. And you sort of have a transition gig working in the NFT space and the Web3 space as sort of a bridge, if you will, to the present, working with One Football.
So I think it was one of the coolest, craziest, hardest year of my career. One of the things that was happening, I think, is more of my inner development. I was like, am I good or am I just behind these amazing brands? And then am I good or have I just been in the sports industry for so long that you know how to move the machine, right? So I wanted to go do something else. And then this NFT blockchain gold rush was booming. And when I joined One Football, we had just raised 300 million in a 1.3 billion valuation. And One Football, it's a soccer app for content distribution that we at back then we had about 110 million monthly active users. And the business case was, hey, what if we convert 10% of these people in trading NFTs with us? And the same thing where NBA did with NBA Top Shot in the US, we wanted to do for football. The difference in the struggles is that the US market is heavily ingrained into collections and collectibles, where the European market, you don't have so much of, in the US, people have been trading baseball cards for so many years. And then we thought applying the same business model to Europe football, you would pay off the same way. And then we've learned the hard way that it didn't. But it was good for me to go in and understand and learn what a startup feels like, what a scale-up feels like. And from a marketing perspective, I was the second marketing person to join. And then I built a team of 35 people in 6 months to, unfortunately, the Web3 business in Penal that we had to kind of spin around and lay off everybody pretty much.
Yeah, I think the last chapter is yet to be written, but the whole story of Web3, the metaverse, we've seen tremendous amounts of money spent both at Apple and at Meta on the virtual reality, headgear, if you will. One of my friends, Shahar Scott, runs the Meta product, and it's a big priority for the company. I love Shahar. I just don't know that that's going to pan out.
In 2010, I was at Nokia in London, leading product marketing for smartphones. And in 2010, we were working on a technology for augmented reality on your smartphone where you would hold your phone in the city, and then you had this 3D landscape of the city coming up. And they look, your point of interest locations will come up, and then you would tap into it, and they would navigate you there. And then we wanted, NFC, we're working with NFC, near field communication, to tap on your Oyster card on your phone. That was like 2010. The problem we had is that the technology infrastructure was not there yet. We didn't have a 5G. So in order for you to load the entire experience, it was way too expensive from a data plan consumption perspective. So I think like what we experience now with AR, VR, all of these things is that the infrastructure and the market and the consumer behavior is not there yet. But it, in my personal humble opinion, is inevitable that it will be. Maybe you and I will not experience that and we're not going to see that. But my daughter and my son, who is 3 years old, that's going to be native to how they live their life. Like, it's incredible. My daughter, 9 years old, she came home one day. She goes, hey, Daddy, can I show you this presentation I built at school? So I'm like, okay. So I thought she's gonna come with a cardboard, right? How I used to do science fair at school. She's like, can you log in on your Google Slides? And I'm like, what? So she has her own Google account for the school. She goes on Google Slides. She built this beautiful presentation with music, with a video that she edited, and she's 9. Like, I don't think I've learned that until it's like 27. So I think these things, man, like, it's inevitable. It's here to stay. Maybe you and I were not going to see it, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, no, and I think your notion of the digital natives and those that are growing up with that technology, very different experience than folks like me who come from that analog world. All right, so let's talk about EFG. It's a huge player, once again, cast in an enormous global role. Let's talk about how you got there, Fabio.
I got there through headhunting. A former colleague of mine at Adidas left Adidas and then went into recruitment and headhunting. And he reached out to me and he's like, hey, I have something that I think you would be really interested. I've been flirting with gaming for quite some time. I had several conversations with EA Sports and Riot, but nothing ever panned out. So I've been always intrigued by gaming and esports. And then I was like, oh, sure. And I started interviewing, and I started learning about what EFG is, the size of the company, the scale of everything that we do here. And I was like, I started falling in love with the idea, right? As a marketer, what gives me energy is to work on things that are the heartbeat of culture. And gaming and esports today is at the heartbeat of culture.
So for me, EFG is one of those gee, I didn't know that stories. I'm not a gamer, but I certainly have a lot of friends at EA. We helped launch their advertising business many, many years ago at Advertising Week. We have a lot of good friends at King and Activision, Blizzard. EFG is not one that I'm all that familiar with. So give us a sense. This is an awfully big operation that you're now leading globally for all marketing.
So, as an entire company, we are about 1,000 employees. We are the largest esports and gaming ecosystem in the world. And the best way to describe is everything that is not the actual game title, we build. So we build the largest tournaments, we build the leagues, we create the product, the experience. So the way I like to describe is imagine if the ATP in tennis would merge with ESPN. So we're both the league, the tournament, and we're the broadcast, right? So our business model is media rights, viewership, broadcast, sponsorships, ticket sales, merchandising, and we have a few products. We have ESL, which is the Esports League Pro Tour, where you have the Counter-Strike, Dota, Rocket League, like all of that kind of, ecosystem. Then we have DreamHack Festival, which think of Coachella, but for gaming. And we just had one in Dallas where we had about 55,000 people in a period of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then the third product is Face It. Face It is a digital platform that you go in there, you create a login, and you actually, it's a matchmaking, I like to say, is the Tinder of gaming. So we have this incredible AI technology called Minerva that allows you to match your game against people or with communities that within the same level that you play based on your playing behavior. Because here's an example, man. Imagine if I say, hey, Matt, you want to come over to my house and we're going to play basketball? And then you show up, I have LeBron James on my team. You're going to get crushed and you're not going to have fun. So on Face It, we actually, match you with the right level. Also, now with Face It, we launched Face It Watch, where as you're watching competitive gaming, you can choose the point of view of how you want to watch the game. So you can choose up to four point of view. You can choose from two players and you can choose from the in-game camera. So everybody can create their own experience in watching the way they want. Just to wrap it up, what esports and gaming brings to brands that want to be part of it is what we have in our community at EFG is the most valuable asset that any brand leader in the world would like to have, which is attention. The audience that engage with us, either virtually or in our physical events, because we have always on competition on an online basis, on average, people who come and watch some of our leagues online on Faceit, they're spending between 2 to 4 hours every time they are with us online on a daily basis. If you come to our event, you arrive at 9 in the morning and everybody will leave around 9 to 10 p.m. So what we have is what I coined audience captivity. We have their undivided attention for that time that it's like we say gaming is Gen Z's biggest game. Actually, every other weekend, we produce a Super Bowl from an hour's watch perspective.
Incredible story, and I love that audience captivity notion. I think your focus on attention is such an important currency today. It's what brands are looking for, is how can they capture the attention of their audience. I think this next chapter for you is going to be awfully exciting. Talk about the Esports World Cup as we wrap, and then I would be remiss, Fabio, I know that you are also a podcast host. Just a preview, I'd love to talk about that as we wrap, but give us a little bit about the Esports World Cup, which is just tremendously exciting.
So this is the first ever Esports World Cup, right? And we are the white label partner of the Esports World Cup Foundation. So we built the product, we operationalized the event, and we do the marketing for the Esports World Cup. The Esports World Cup is going to happen in Saudi Arabia in Riyadh in July and August. So it's 8 weeks with 3,000 esports players coming together to compete in 21 game titles. So think of the Olympic Games for clubs instead of nations. So every club can come and build teams for one of those 21 game titles or for all of them. And the club with the most points will win, be crowned the esports world champion. So it's a point system based, 3,000 players, multi-title, multi-format. It's the largest esports festival in the world, and it's extremely exciting. It's also another huge opportunity to go back to our very beginning of changing the world's perception of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as, you know, gaming, it's one of the biggest economic drivers for Saudi's future.
Great, great story. And let's talk about your podcast.
So the podcast, the marketing marriage, my wife is a marketer as well. She's VP of marketing on Foot Locker Europe. We met at Nike, and then we also went to Adidas together. So we actually like we did the whole sport culture thing, and she's still in sport and sneakers. And as a dual career couple, expat, we end up always just hosting colleagues at home. We love to host people at home and have dinners and nice wine. And we end up talking about work, right? We also went to the same business school at Kellogg. We overlap a year, never met, end up meeting at Nike 2 years later. And then we're like, hey, why don't we have a podcast and bring some of the friends and people we met along the way to talk about marketing? But also, we want to take a different spin to it and say, hey, we don't want to be the marketing podcast that has all the answers to everything, because of what we wanted to do is to pull the curtain behind the human of the leader that we're interviewing, right? And we had some really incredible guests with, Davide Grasso, who is CEO of Maserati, Antonio Lucio, who is now CMO of HP, right? Melissa Hobley, CMO at Tinder, and the whole thing in some of those conversations. A few of them tell us, and then it's like, oh my gosh, I actually talked about things that I've never talked in publicly because you guys just made me feel safe and vulnerable. Of course, we start with who is the person behind the leader, How did your life story help inform your leadership style? And then we finish in marketing, right? Like, how are you applying this to marketing and what are you doing and what do you think it's coming up the marketing that we should pay attention to?
All right. Well, you just gave me another show to put on my list. I'm so glad that Mary connected us, Fabio. This was an awful lot of fun to talk to you and hear your story. Very much an ongoing story. And I think the excitement of what's happening at EFG is a great, great point for us to sort of anchor ourselves in looking at where we are not only today, but where we're going tomorrow. So thanks for joining us on Great Minds. This was an absolute treat.
Thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it and hope I did not disappoint you.
Not at all. Not at all. Okay, buddy. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.